We welcome back to the program at University of Maine, professor, author, writer, man of letters, our friend Michael Sokolow joins us. Mike, good afternoon.
Hi, Rick.
Great to have you with us on this day after the big settlement that has, I think, disappointed a lot of people who thought it was going to end differently, but it seemed to make sense for me that this was the way it would play out.
Right, I think so. I think the chances that this would get to the stars on the witness stand and Rupert Murdoch being questioned were very slim.
Now, you pointed out, and you've talked about this with us before, that the number of people who actually watch Fox News on a regular basis is nowhere near as big as people might think. And so how much impact do they have on America as a whole?
Well, it's a really interesting question. The first part of that question is they have less than they used to. So about 3 million, a little over 3 million people in the year of 2020, which was a big news year. There was an election and COVID and everything. A little over 3 million people watched primetime Fox News. In January of this year, the latest numbers show about 1.95 million. They've lost about a third of their audience in 3 years. Now, most of that, CNN has also lost a million viewers. Most of it is cord cutting. Most of it has nothing to do with the politics. But they're just not nearly as powerful as they were 5 years ago. Now, the thing about their ability to persuade and influence is they don't change anybody's mind. Fox News doesn't change anybody's mind.
Right.
But it does motivate people who would otherwise might stay home to go out and vote for the candidates that Fox supports. So Fox does have an effect. It's just kind of limited, and it's not what most people think.
Now, you mentioned those numbers. By contrast, I think ABC World News Tonight, David Muir is, I believe, number one among the three major networks. How many people might watch them in a given night?
Oh, he's 9, 10 million. He's more than three times, four times the size of Fox News, David Muir.
All right, so in terms of Fox, we know what was in it for them. We know why it was important for them to settle. It's interesting they let it go on as long as they did. Why was it in Dominion's best interest to settle?
There's 787 million reasons. the amount is astonishing. You know, I was curious because I wanted to run the numbers. I thought, you know, if Fox News hired an employee to make up for the payment they're making, how much would that employee make since Fox News began in 1996? And it's $29 million a year since Fox News began. Tucker Carlson makes $35 million a year, so it's a little less than the most important person on air at Fox for 30 years that they've never had to pay up. I mean, it's so mind-boggling, the scale of this. You know, the entire capitalized value, it's owned by a private hedge fund, the private equity fund, the Dominion Voting Systems, but their entire value was at most $100 million before yesterday. So imagine you owned a company and suddenly somebody offered you after, by the way, after they defamed you and ruined your company's reputation, but they offered you seven times the value of your company.
I guess I would take that too. Absolutely. Now, we've still got the Smartmatics lawsuit. I think they're asking for a little less than $3 billion. Do you expect it will follow a similar path?
It will, but it won't be nearly as much for a different reason. Smartmatic is a much smaller company to begin with. And Dominion, the lies about Dominion, here's where it gets a little bit into the weeds, but the lies about Dominion were big, they were national, and they were repeated several times. The Smartmatic software was actually only used in one small area of Los Angeles.
Mm.
And so if you go back and you look at Fox's series of lies, they actually lied much, much more about Dominion than Smartmatic. So it'll be a lot harder. Smartmatic is a smaller company with a lot less reach, and Fox stopped talking about them much more quickly. It's not going to be anywhere in the ballpark of this, but Smartmatic will make out with a large amount of money.
We'll talk more about the impact on Fox in a little bit, but in terms of smaller outlets like a Newsmax, does this strike a little fear into their hearts?
Actually, it's funny you say that, Rich. I thought just the opposite. I thought yesterday's one of yesterday's big winners was Newsmax and OAN because there's a needle you can thread here, right? You can say really crazy stuff that has no relationship to reality, as long as you don't have the phone and text messages and emails showing that you don't believe it. Because the settlement was based not on the fact that they were telling defamatory falsehoods. The settlement was based on the fact that they knowingly, with malice, told the defamatory falsehoods. So, if you're a QAnon believer and you work at Newsmax and you want to spread the gospel of Donald Trump winning a landslide in 2020 and you don't have texts and emails saying that you don't believe it, you're fine.
Well, and that's what made this such a difficult case to begin with. The standard is so high because you have to know that what you're saying is false, and you have to be saying it with the intent to defame and harm the other party.
Yeah, and a fascinating thing after the settlement, Smartmatic gave a very brief statement. I read it in Slate, and it was very happy. And they said, essentially, you ain't seen nothing yet. But the Smartmatic discovery hasn't happened yet, and that'll decide how big, how big anything they win is. Because I think it's going to be a little harder to find the malice for Smartmatic, but we'll see. We don't know yet.
Now, does Fox face any real financial peril from these investors who were talking about suing the company?
Unfortunately not. I mean, the amount of money that Fox News has is staggering. They were preparing, the Wall Street Journal on Friday had an article about this, they were preparing a stock buyback to enrich their shareholders, meaning the Murdoch shareholders. And over the course of the last couple of years, they've been hoarding cash for the stock buyback. So they're sitting on $4 billion. So $787 million hit to their $4 billion stock buyback just reduces it down to $3 billion. It's really not as big a hit to them as one would hope, frankly.
We're talking with Michael Sokolow here on Downtown. Last night, apparently between 7 and 11, those primetime hours, there was no mention on Fox of the settlement yesterday, and that shouldn't come as a surprise to anybody. No apology as part of the settlement, and so will this change practices at the network?
I really think it's too early to tell. I really do, for a whole bunch of reasons. But the biggest reason is we won't know for a few months whether they install a new kind of approval process for the legal reasons. And it, not to get too into the weeds, but it kind of follows a question about whether they can get liability insurance. I mean, it's hard to imagine. They had liability insurance going into this lawsuit, which helped them pay the legal bills to a certain point. But I can't imagine if they don't change what they do that any insurer in the world would insure them. So it's really, it's a complicated question, and anybody who says they know that Fox News will change or won't change has no idea right now.
Now, we know from those internal texts that Tucker Carlson, Sean Hannity, Laura Ingraham, and others were very concerned and wanted to make sure they didn't alienate the base, the viewership. But for any network, you want to try and find a way to grow your audience. How does Fox do that? Because they seem to be catering everything to this very specific, mostly older, mostly white group of viewers. How do they branch out and plan for the future?
Rich, you're thinking back in the old 20th century broadcast mode, the mass audience. But in the era of cord cutting, the fringe element of your audience, the people who are still willing to pay, are the people you need to cater to. So that's why Fox is doing that. They're going further and further out on a limb to retain the last people who are still willing to pay for them. Anybody young has cut the cord, so they just don't care about that.
So in terms of that, we were talking about this before the show this afternoon. Now, to get people organized enough to do this is highly unlikely, but would some sort of consumer backlash against cable carriers, satellite companies carry any weight if people said, I don't want to be here paying for Fox when I don't want to watch it and they're spreading misinformation?
Unfortunately not, and that goes back decades. I mean, the hero of that movement was John McCain, who every 2 years would put a bill in the Senate and introduce it in the Senate and get a partner to do it in the House, and every time it would be voted down in committee. It never even made the floor, I don't think. John McCain kept saying, and you could see his speeches, they're hilarious. He was against bundling of cable. He said, why don't we just pay for the channels we want? You know, it's a very simple consumer thing. When you go in a supermarket, they don't make you buy five different brands of soup. They let you choose the brand of soup you want. Cable TV should be exactly the same. But the cable TV lobby and bundling, it's called, bundling the channels together, you know, for decades has defeated that. So I don't think a movement's really going to work.
Now, we know the Republican Party, the right wing in general, has seen media as a building block for their future, for locking up that base and doing what they need to do, getting the word out by keeping that loyalty out there. And are we seeing more and more efforts to take control of local media? I think of the Sinclair Group and what they've done right here in the state of Maine with, I think it's the CBS affiliate in Portland.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I'm not sure what's going to end up happening there, because Sinclair got in trouble with their purchase of the regional sports networks, and they're having serious financial issues compared to Nexstar, for instance, which is building this News Nation channel. And I haven't watched enough of the News Nation channel to see how it's working, but there is a lot of different moving parts on the local and the broadcast and what it means in terms of the politics of it. And, you know, there is this theory that as Fox goes out and chases its fringe, as MSNBC goes out and chases its fringe, that the middle is going to open up, you know? And this is the theory that Chris Licht at CNN is doing right now, you know? Getting rid of the people who kind of, you know, whether it's Chris Cuomo, Brian Stelter, getting rid of people who sort of are identified with specific political positions and trying for the middle. It'll be interesting to see if it works.
So as you look at this as a media historian, where can we point the fingers of blame? When did it start to go wrong? Is it as simple as CNN and the birth of the 24-hour news cycle and the need to fill those hours leading to the blurry line between news and commentary?
You know, it's funny. I'm not sure how wrong it is, and I don't mean that as a critique of what you said. I think we overestimate how much Fox really influences our political sphere. And I'll give you an example. Joe Biden in the last 6 months has basically halved his disapproval rating. If you go to 538 and you look at his rating, his disapproval to approval has been closing the gap like crazy over the last 6 months. And literally, it's half of what it was 6 months ago. Fox News attacks him every single night, and it's not working. Just the opposite. He's getting more popular. And so, it's an interesting question. The second part is the misinformation, the idea that we're all our own experts and that we trust our neighbor over a scientist. That is a social media phenomenon. I would say the misinformation question is really a Facebook issue.
If you're working with young journalists, you know, what do you say to them if they think of a future and certainly would like to be financially well off at some point, too? I would think some of them have to look at the cable outlets and say, you know, that's the way to go. No one's paying the hard news guy a lot of money, but if I can be a commentator, if I can be on one side or the other and stir people up, there's money to be made and a career to be had.
Yeah, unfortunately, it's very true. And you know, the interesting thing is the smart student, what they would do is they'd go work on a local paper or a local TV station, and they'd get the reporting skills that they need in
right.
order to understand the formatting of the news articles. Because the thing that the thing that Fox News or MSNBC wants is somebody who looks and sounds just like a professional reporter, but still supports their political position, you know, in terms of strategic comm. So that's the way to go, is to get the training first and then get there. But I agree, where the money is quite problematic in that sense.
And you mentioned the numbers for the network newscast, but are those, much like Fox, are they largely older Americans that are watching?
They are, but they make so much money. You know, ABC News, World News Tonight, makes makes probably around $450 or $500 million a year, which is a third of what Fox makes operating 24 hours a day. And David Weir is only on 30 minutes. And the reason is drugs. In 1998, the Food and Drug Administration allowed much loosening, and the FTC together, a huge loosening of drug advertisements. And if you turn on any of these local newscasts today, it's nothing but drug ads. And they're sold at a premium, and there's what keeping those channels and networks lucrative.
And how do you look at the balance of, the desire to find real information out there, as it swung more toward the national outlets, as we see a disappearance of local newspapers, a less local reporting on local TV stations, even the network affiliates?
It's a great question, and it's not really... The dynamic has reversed itself. Now it's up to the audience to figure out credibility and accuracy. It used to be up to the journalists to prove their credibility and accuracy.
Mm.
But if you believe vaccines are, you know, if you believe vaccines are some demonic thing and they shouldn't be taken, now the audience is giving the credibility to the nutcase who's sending that around. So it's really a conundrum that there's no answer to, except, I mean, what people are pointing out is media literacy, understanding how to counter your own bias. But it doesn't seem to be working quite that well.
And does it matter for the good of the country that we don't have a place we can turn to where the majority of Americans agree they're going to get largely truthful news and information?
That, you know... What's interesting, Rich, is we live in Maine, which is the oldest state in the United States, and there are enough people here in Maine who can remember that world and know what's been lost. My concern that I'm sort of fascinated by is basically people 10 years younger than us never saw that world and never lived in that world, have no idea what a you know, Peter Jennings or a Walter Cronkite or a Huntley Brinkley were. And not only that, if you go on YouTube, you can't even really understand by watching them what they meant to people watching in the 60s. So it's you know, I'm not sure if we'll get it back. I don't know who it'll be when it does come back. But it is a fascinating question to have so many people who did not live in that world.
And are we remembering it the way it really was? Or were there a fairly solid percentage of people who in 1968 said, I knew that Cronkite was a communist. There he is telling us to get out of Vietnam.
There's a great book out by an MIT professor named Heather Hendershot called When the News Broke. And it's exactly that. With the police riot in Chicago in 1968, you know, CBS reported it accurately. She went back, she watched it all and everything, and it was professional journalism. It was all accurate and everything. And the letters ran 11-1 against CBS's reporting for the Chicago police, who were beating up the hippies. You know, the people didn't believe what they were told or what they saw with their own eyes. They believed that the hippies attacked the police and got what they deserved. It's a fascinating study, and she argues that basically it all started there, where people just refused to believe what was in front of them.
Mike, this is Bruce Pratt. Well, the question I would ask about that was, I mean, I remember that very well. I was 17 years old, that Daley and his machine were pumping out a lot of that stuff to other media sources in Illinois that the National were also picking up. So was that part of it, that was the first real pushback against journalism in order to save somebody's skin?
Yeah, absolutely. And she makes that argument. You know, everybody looks at Spiro Agnew and Richard Nixon attacking the media. But she goes back and she looks right after the convention that he did. Mayor Daley was incredible what he said about the press and the media. And both to Chicago and local Illinois and to the national media. And he went on kind of a rampage, and it really hurt. And she shows how it hurt, and Johnson kind of joined him a little bit, but not quite as much, but it hurt Humphrey in that election to have the Democrats saying that, you know, the media is lying to you about what's going on in Vietnam and what happened in Chicago. And so in some ways, Nixon, her book is excellent. In some ways, Nixon took that little teeny start and blew it up like crazy because he saw how effective it was.
All right, let me ask you this before we let you go, Michael. Why aren't left-wing broadcasters as successful, whether it's in terms of rating or revenue, why aren't they as successful as the right-wing broadcasters?
I mean, it depends on how you define successful. Right-wingers would tell you that national public radio has, you know, 20, 30 million listeners, as big as Rush Limbaugh. And right-wingers would call national public radio left-wing. So it's a little bit of a complicated question in that sense, is how we have the definitions. But my guess is, that's a tough question that involves issues of skepticism and how audiences would approach their media. And I think the liberal, your average liberal, is more willing to accept what the New York Times, National Public Radio says as credible and verifiable than a right-winger. And so that creates, it. You know, if we look at this giant middle of the mainstream media, and that creates the opening for the right-wing media.
And do you think NPR's departure from Twitter and other outlets that are considering the same thing will have any impact on that?
I don't know. I mean, Twitter is a mess. It's a, yeah. it's a fascinating yeah. mess. But the thing I'm realizing is more and more people are leaving it. Its influence is really, I mean, stark in the last 6 months. Twitter will not be America's assignment editor in the election of 2024. And that's fascinating to me.
And is there someone out there that's likely to step up and assume that role? Or have people's habits changed in this relatively short period of time?
Well, one of the things I laugh about is, in your lifetime, Rich, have you seen a luckier president than Joe Biden?
No.
All of his enemies are collapsing at once.
Yeah.
Twitter is self-destructing. That guy O'Keefe, Project Veritas, thrown out of his own company. Donald Trump is indicted. I mean, it's amazing to me. And I don't think Biden or his administration has much to do with it. I mean, there's this whole argument, right, about Bragg and whatever, and Garland. But it's I don't think I've seen a luckier president.
Well, no, and then he gets Trump to inadvertently help him by taking Ron DeSantis out of the picture, I think.
It's really, I mean, somebody should make a list of all the things that Biden has. I mean, the Pennsylvania Senate race, the Georgia, losing the two senators in Georgia. It's astonishing, the run of luck. Now, you could argue, well, no, it's not luck. The Republicans have caused their own problems. But those two things are sort of connected.
Gary?
The other thing, and I this just occurred to me, I wonder if part of the reason that Biden is getting this luck is that he isn't an easy target. He's not a woman. He's not a minority. The attacks that work so well for the right-wing pundits against, you know, the other coming in and replacing you don't work when, because Biden isn't the other. He is an old white guy.
Yeah, well, an interesting thing, I have an argument with a friend of mine who's right wing, and if you don't know this, they have the actual data on media appearances at University of California, Santa Barbara, and Biden is the least accessible media president since Ronald Reagan's second term when Reagan had Alzheimer's, and in the last 100 years, only Richard Nixon, when he was on the way to impeachment, and Ronald Reagan's second term, had fewer media appearances and media accessibilities than Joe Biden has had. They are absolutely hiding him. It's incredible how he is hidden, how well hidden he is. And I consider that brilliant strategy in the White House comms part. But my friend says, no, it's a failure of the mainstream media. You know, the data is out there on how accessible Joe Biden is, but the New York Times isn't putting it on A1.
Well, because they're too busy covering every move that Trump makes.
Exactly.
Well, it's a fascinating topic. Michael, always enjoy talking with you. Thank you so much for making some time for us this afternoon.
Thanks, Rich.
That's Michael Sokolow, University of Maine, 25 minutes after 5 o'clock. That's
so great. I love every time you have him on.